The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Having saved Sweet Apple, Texas from disaster, the Blood Brothers, Matt Bodine and Sam Two Wolves, decide to stay and help the new marshal, Seymour the Lily-Livered Standish, break in his spurs.
Hello, Uncle Cornelius! Miss Jimerson!
Hello, Seymour. I don't mean to stare, it's just that...
You look like a character out of a dime novel.
I'm not sure how well suited we are for an adventure like this.
I don't give a damn about that. Just make sure that little bastard dies.
What are you doing over here, Colton? You know you're not welcome on this ranch.
I've come for justice. Two of my men were murdered earlier today, but I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, am I, Paxton?
Seymour, don't you understand? Don't you know how I feel about you?
Rebecca, I thought we had settled this.
You! I knew you were up to no good! You trollop!
Maggie!
Rebecca!
Stop! Stop that!
Between catfights, range wars, and attempts on Seymour's life, the new marshal and his unofficial deputies have got their hands full. But the dance is just beginning.
Alcazario!
They took the girls!
Sandy! Those bastards took Sandy!
And Jesse!
Matt! They're gone!
You mean Miss Orion?
And Miss Jimerson! They're both gone!
Now Seymour, Matt, and Sam must lead a posse across the Rio Grande to find the kidnapped women before Alcazario can realize his evil plans for them. But some of the rescuers have plans of their own, and the Marshal of Sweet Apple may have led his last posse. Blood Bond number 12, Ride for Vengeance, new from Graphic Audio.
Be proud before the gods, for blood and rank are thine, and...
Kilov is alive, and he wields such power. Roxxon must know.
Bow to honor, swear to honor,
hungry for secrets!
Chen, Archer, Sharansky, we're going to Africa. We got a message from Rahala. Says it's vitally important. Kilov's got this weapon that can move mountains.
Doomsday Warrior 15, American Ultimatum.
So this is how it all ends.
Whoa, shit! Did that elephant just shoot a fucking laser at me?
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's The First Mountain Man 11, Preacher's Journey. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by Richard Rowan, Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Ken Jackson, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, Eric Mesner, Christopher Graybill, Andy Clements, David Coyne, Karen Carbone, James Lewis, Tim Carlin, Kate Torrey, and Michael Replogle. Sometimes, days went by when he didn't think of her. And when he realized that, it saddened him. Sometimes of an evening, when he sat by his lonely campfire, he tried to conjure up the image of her face, and he couldn't. No matter how hard he tried, he just couldn't remember exactly what she looked like. The caress of her voice, the music of her laugh, they became equally elusive. Jenny. He'd been fond of her when he was a boy. He had loved her when he was a man. And now she was gone, foully murdered by a son of a bitch not worthy of kissing the hem of her dress or licking the sole of her shoe. Her death had been avenged, but the pain of her loss was still there, lurking in the back of his mind more than 2 years later, ready to leap out like a hobgoblin when it was least expected. For a time, the pain had been his only friend. Well, that and the big wolf-like dog known only as Dog. But eventually, it began to recede, washed away by time and hard work in the glorious surroundings in the Rocky Mountains. He'd welcomed the easing of the pain until he realized that it meant the memories were beginning to fade, too. That was bad, because he never wanted to lose any of his memories of Jenny. Preacher reined in the big hammer-headed dun.
You smell it too, old fella? Snow. Winter's coming on. Be here before you know it. But it's time for it, I reckon.
Preacher was a tall man in buckskins and a coat made from the hide of a bear. Lean but not skinny, he packed plenty of hard muscle on his frame. At the moment, he sported a thick mustache and a beard that he kept cropped relatively close with a hunting knife. Under a brown felt hat with a broad floppy brim, his hair was black as a raven's wing. His age was difficult to tell, because he had always looked a little older than his true years. He was 31, and he had been making his own way in the world since he was 12, sometimes with the help from companions, but often alone, except for a horse or a mule and dog. When he was little more than a boy, he had made a promise to a dying friend that he would come west and see the creature for himself, since they couldn't go together as planned. And he had done it. Traveling the Shining Mountains, as the Rockies were sometimes called in those days. He had seen the creature all right. He had seen it plenty. Now he saw something that shouldn't have been there, though. Tendril of smoke climbing into the pewter blue sky above the valley spread out before him. Preacher's pale gray eyes narrowed. There shouldn't have been anybody in that valley. With winter coming on, the prime fur trapping season was over for a while. Some of the mountain men had gone back to St. Louis or elsewhere closer to civilization to spend the winter. Others would pass the months of cold weather with friendly Indians. A few, like Preacher, would live alone, traveling their own paths until rendezvous in the spring. But he was acquainted with most of those men, and he knew that none of them planned to winter in this valley. Besides, no mountain man worth his salt would build a fire big enough to give off that much smoke. It would announce his presence to any unfriendly Indians who were in the area. And besides, it was damn wasteful.
Must be white men. Pilgrims at that.
Yeah! Now, Preacher could have ignored it. He could have ridden the other way. But he had a powerful curiosity. And most of the time, he went where it took him. That meant trouble. Pilgrims always did. Time was, these mountains had been the sole province of the Indians. Then the fur trappers had come. First Frenchmen down from Canada, then after Lewis and Clark's expedition to the Pacific, Americans who traipsed out from St. Louis following the Missouri River. A fellow named Manuel Lisa had bankrolled the first American fur trapping party. Others had followed. Coulter, Bridger, Holt, and Clyde Barnes and Pierre Garneau, who had saved Preacher's life. These and hundreds more like him had come to the mountains to harvest the beaver pelts. Some of them had gotten along with the Indians, and some of them hadn't. But they hadn't disrupted life in the high country too much. But movers? Well, now, movers were a different story. Immigrants from back east had just gotten started heading west in the past year or so, and already there were too damn many of them to suit Preacher, traveling in those big wagons that came rolling and creaking across the plains and through the passes, leaving ruts that marred the ground and might not even come out. Still, if there was trouble, Preacher couldn't turn his back on it. He just wasn't made that way. Preacher topped a rise, reined in again, and looked down on a tree-lined stream meandering along through some lush, grassed bottom land. Four wagons with mule teams hitched to them were sitting alongside the stream, canvas arched high over the rear of the wagons.
Yeah, they're movers all right, dog. Immigrants gotta have wagons like that because it holds a goddamn much stuff with them. They're off the trail, too. They're not gonna get anywhere going in the direction they're heading except deeper into the mountains. They gotta be lost.
The smoke came from a big fire near the creek. The pilgrims had gathered broken branches into a large pile and set them ablaze. Preacher's keen eyes made out a big iron pot set on stands at the edge of the fire. They were either cooking stew or heating water for something.
Huh. I don't smell no stew. Yeah, my teeth are a mite on edge, too. You reckon we ought to ride down there and turn those folks around, send them back where they come from? Hell, if we get to talking to them, they're liable to ask me to lead them on to the promised land. And I ain't in no mood to play Moses. Yeah, that's what I thought. Good Lord Almighty, somebody's torturing that poor guy!
The odd thing was that several people were moving around the wagons, tending to the mules and chores like that. They didn't seem the least bit disturbed by the agonized screeches. The dog turned his head sharply toward the east. Preacher's instinct for trouble started to bubble up even harder than before, and he looked in the same direction as dog. What he saw made his hands tighten on the hawking across the saddle in front of him. A half dozen or so figures were slipping along the creek toward the wagons, sneaking through the aspens and cottonwoods that grew along the banks. Preacher saw buckskins and feathers and a few bright splashes of color that told him the stealthy figures had painted their faces, painted for war.
Boy.
Preacher was about 300 yards from the creek. A ball from the Hawkin would carry that far without any trouble.
Push now. Don't get your fur in an uproar.
Preacher drew a bead on the warrior who was closest to the wagons. The engine staggered, blood welled from his mouth, and he pitched forward on his face. Now that their surprise attack was ruined, the engine burst from the trees and raced toward the pilgrims. Preacher shot and warned the immigrants, though, and they went diving for the cover of the wagons. Preacher had to give the pilgrims a little reluctant credit for being prepared. At least they had some loaded weapons close at hand. Preacher swapped rifles as he rode, pulling the loaded one from the saddle boot and ramming the empty back in its place. He guided the gun down the slope with his knee. Preacher leapt from the saddle and landed on his feet. Another warrior flopped onto the ground, his lifeblood pouring out onto the grass from the hideous wound. Dog flashed by, a gray streak low to the ground, as Preacher drew the pistols from behind his belt. He had covered enough distance in his initial charge that he was now within range for the shotguns. An arrow tugged at the fringe of his buckskin jacket as he cocked and leveled the right-hand pistol. Preacher was already pivoting and drawing another bead before that warrior hit the ground. There was only one engine left. The lone survivor had a bullet burn on his arm, a souvenir of the volley that had come from the wagons, but the minor wound didn't slow him down as he charged at Preacher. Preacher dropped the empty pistols and yanked a hunting knife from its sheath. He got the heavy blade up just in time to block a tomahawk stroke. Preacher grabbed the wrist of the hand in which the warrior held the tomahawk. The engine grabbed the wrist of Preacher's knife hand. Muscles straining, they stood there locked together, each knowing that the first one who slipped or eased up was gonna die. The engine suddenly tried to hook Preacher's leg with his foot and pull it out from under him. Preacher shifted his stance with blinding speed, and the warrior missed his try. That gave Preacher his chance. He got a heel behind the engine's leg and jerked. Preacher went down with the engine, using the impetus of his fall to break free of the brave's grip. He raised his knife over the man's chest. Preacher pushed himself up and tugged the knife free, then wiped the blade on the dead warrior's buckskin as he knelt beside the corpse.
Good fight, fella.
Preacher turned toward the wagons, thinking to see if any of the immigrants had been wounded or killed, when he got a surprise. One of the pilgrims was coming at him, his rifle pointed in a threatening manner.
Stand right there, mister! Don't move or I'll shoot!
You better point that damn thing at the ground, friend. In case you didn't notice, I just risked my own scalp to keep these engines from taking yours. We're on the same side.
You're one of those wild mountain men. How do we know you won't try to kill us?
The man was tall and fairly muscular for a pilgrim, with a shock of black hair and bushy black eyebrows.
Peter! Peter, wait!
The man turned his head toward the shout, and that was all the opening preacher needed. The pilgrim toppled like a sack of potatoes, out cold.
Back away from him. If you try to hurt him again, we'll kill you.
Preacher looked toward the wagons and saw that another young man and two older ones were advancing slowly toward him. The older men were armed with rifles, while the younger one held a brace of pistols.
Hurt him again? He was the one waving a rifle around. Like I told him, I'm on the same side as you folks, or I wouldn't have come down here to give you a hand.
That makes sense, Roger. I think Peter just lost his head. This man saved our lives.
Now you're talking. Why don't we all just take a deep breath here and calm down, huh?
The young man called Roger lowered his pistols.
Yes. You're right, of course. I'm sorry.
Roger nodded toward the man still lying dazed on the ground.
My brother just lost his head. I'm Roger Galloway, and that's my brother Peter there on the ground. And these are my uncles Jeffrey and Jonathan Galloway.
And they call me Preacher.
Not the Preacher.
Why, you're famous.
Oh, Lord. Look, never mind about me. What are you folks doing up here in the high country? What are you doing to that woman?
Oh, don't worry. That's just my wife.
Your wife?
The preacher turned in the direction of the new commotion, swung around and stepped over to his horse, which had come to a halt nearby. He jerked a pair of pistols from the saddle holsters and went toward the trees at a run. The preacher reached the trees and followed the growling until he came to a spot where dogs stood over a buckskin-clad body that lay half in and half out of the water.
Goddamn, dog. I wonder where you gotten off to.
The big wolf-like animal had sniffed out another of the hostiles. Preacher had been right in his original estimation. There had been six Injuns. This one was dead, too, his throat torn out by dog's savage fangs. Preacher rubbed dog's ear.
Good boy. This fellow must have seen things were going bad to try to slip off. If you hadn't stopped him, he would have gone back to his village and likely brought the whole bunch of them down on us. I reckon you saved the day.
But Preacher had made a mistake. It was rare, but it happened every now and then. He was human, after all. Though he had eyes like an eagle, not even he could see everything. There had not been six members of the war party. There had been seven. Now the seventh warrior, a young man called Nakawan, crouched shivering on the bank of the creek several hundred yards from the spot where the wagons of the hated white men were. He had made it into the water when the huge gray wolf attacked him and his companion while they were attempting to get away. Running from a fight went contrary to everything Nakawan believed in, but it was necessary that someone return to the main band and let Swift Arrow know what had happened. Swift Arrow and his warriors had been searching for these whites for some time, and the war chief would be displeased if they were allowed to escape from the righteous vengeance of the Sanish people. While his companion had struggled with the wolf, Nakawan had slipped into the deeper water and started swimming, staying under the surface as long as he possibly could. The water was brutally frigid. Nakawan could stand it for only so long. He crawled out on his back. Nakawan felt even colder as the wind hit its soaked buckskins in his wet skin. A shaft of sunlight found the young warrior where he lay in the brush and warmed him slightly, but not enough to make him stop shivering. He had to move. If he continued to lie here, he would freeze to death before much longer. Nakawan pushed himself onto his hands and knees and climbed slowly and laboriously to his feet. He turned and began to walk, heading east toward the spot where he and the others had split off from Swift Arrow's group to search for the wagons. Though he felt dazed and found it difficult to think, he was confident that his instincts would lead him in the right path. He would backtrack until he found the others, then he would tell his story to Swift Arrow. It would be a proud moment when he told the war chief where to find the hated whites. Exhausted, Nakawan concentrated on moving one foot, then the other, again and again, until it seemed that he had been walking forever.
His brain was so numb with cold that it was several minutes before he realized that he was no longer moving forward. And even then, that awareness slipped away from him. He lay there senseless. So senseless, he was completely unaware of the bear approaching him. When Preacher got back to the wagons, he saw that Peter Galloway was on his feet again, although still looking a little dazed from the punch that had laid him out. Those bushy eyebrows drew down in an angry frown as he saw Preacher striding toward him. Peter's brother Roger stood by him with the two older men, Jeffrey and Jonathan, behind him. Roger was shorter and slighter than Peter, with sandy hair, and he looked a little older.
Don't lose your temper again, Peter. This man is here to help us.
Sorry I jumped you, mister. I guess I was just too worked up from those Indians attacking us.
I don't hear that woman hollering no more. You mind telling me what the hell's going on?
That's my wife, Dorothy, you heard earlier. She's, in the family way and is about to, is about to...
Is baby being birthed in that wagon?
Yes, to put it a bit indelicately.
Baby's got a habit of coming into this world whenever they take a notion to. Ain't nobody can do anything about that. You got anybody in there helping the lady?
My wife is helping.
She knows about such things, does she?
Both of our wives have had children before. They're not without experience in the process, Mr. Preacher.
It's no mister, just Preacher.
Preacher noticed three kids peeking at him from the back of the wagons. The oldest one was a tow-headed boy who appeared to be about 10. The two others were a brown-haired girl, 5 or 6 years old, and a black-haired boy a year or so younger. They wore the expressions of mingled fear and curiosity. But as usual with young'uns, curiosity had the upper hand.
Sounds like she's having a mighty hard time of it.
It's been a difficult labor. A difficult time for Dorothy all around, I'm afraid. But I'm sure she'll be just fine. Women always scream when they're giving birth.
You'd know that if you've ever been around any civilized women.
I've been around civilized women.
Preacher turned away from the group.
Well, better do something about these bodies.
We can help you.
The older man named Jonathan stepped forward. He was stout, with white hair and a mustache. His brother Jeffrey stepped up as well. Jeffrey was shorter and slighter than his brother, clean-shaven with wispy gray hair under a broad-brimmed hat. All of them wore functional homespun, leather, and whipcord garments, no doubt purchased back in St. Louis or wherever they had started from. With Jeffrey and Jonathan trailing him, the preacher walked back to where the bodies of the warriors lay scattered. For the first time, he had a chance to really study the way they wore their hair, the markings on their faces, and the decorations on their buckskins.
Damn! What is it? They're all dead, aren't they?
Well, they've gone under, all right. I'm just a mite surprised to see that they're a Rickara.
That's the tribe they belong to, you mean?
Yeah. See them bits of horn in their hair sticking up like they was real horns? That's a sure sign of them being Rees. That's what some folks call them. They call themselves the Sanish.
I thought all Indians were pretty much the same. They're all savages, aren't they?
Not hardly. Some tribes are right friendly to white folks, even though we came into their part of the country without an invite. And it goes deeper than that. Every tribe has its own way of doing things, its own beliefs. I reckon a fella could spend a whole lifetime out here and not get to know everything there is to know about Indians.
You sound like you like them.
I do. Some of them, anyway. Never had much use for Blackfoot or Pawnee, though.
Jeffrey gestured toward the sprawled bodies.
Surely these creatures are from one of the more warlike tribes.
That's what's got me puzzled. The Arikaras can be fierce when they want to be, but most of the time, if they're left alone, they let folks alone in turn. A few years back, there was a spell when they were on the warpath because some idiots traded them bad whiskey for beaver plues. I was mixed up in that little dust-up myself. But they got over it, except for one warrior who stayed so mad at the whites he went over to the Blackfoot and called himself a Blackfoot just so he could still make war. But since then, the Arikara have been pretty peaceful. Not only that, their usual stopping grounds are at least 100 miles east of here. Something must have really got them stirred up for them to be way over here in the mountains attacking wagon trains. You boys know anything about that?
Of course not. We've never even seen any Indians like these before, have we, Jeffrey?
No, I don't believe we have.
Yeah, well, let's get these bodies buried.
Preacher didn't bother digging a grave for the six corpses. He found a nearby gully, dumped the bodies in it with the help of Jeffrey and Jonathan, and caved in the bank to cover them. Preacher and the two old-timers got back to the wagons and joined up with Roger and Peter. Before long, another man joined the group. He was older, too, and there was a resemblance between him and Jeffrey and Jonathan.
Preacher, this is my father, Simon Galloway.
Simon was stocky like Jonathan, but clean-shaven and mostly bald. He shook hands with Preacher.
Oh, it can't be that bad.
Folks out here in the mountains got to stick together, even when they shouldn't ought to be out here.
What do you mean by that?
Well, Peter, I mean we got to have a talk about what you folks are doing here and what you ought to do next.
What we're doing is simple. We're going to Oregon to settle there.
Now, there's a way to get to Oregon, but this ain't one of them. You ought to be south and west of here, heading for one of the passes through the mountains.
No, we're going to go around the mountains to the north.
Around the mountains to the north?
That's right. A guide we talked to at a trading post a few weeks ago told us there was no good way through the mountains, so the smart travelers go around them to the north.
Uh-huh. This fellow you talked to, what was his name?
Let me think. Drummond, I believe he said.
Well, I don't know him personal, but I do know Drummond told you wrong. There ain't no way to get around these mountains. They run from somewhere way up in Canada all the way down to Mexico. You could go north from now on and never get to the end of them.
That can't be right. Mr. Drummond seemed so sure.
Well, he was having some sport with you then. Reckon he didn't care that what he told you might wind up getting you killed.
No, it can't be that bad.
Yeah, it's that bad. Winter's coming and probably coming fast. There's been a snow or two already in these parts, and one day soon, sure enough, blizzard will come roaring down out of the north. When that happens, temperature's going to drop down to 30 or 40 below zero. Wind will blow so hard you won't be able to stand up. When it's all over, there'll be 3 or 4 feet of snow on the ground, deeper in the drifts, too.
Peter's face turned pale, which made the bushy black eyebrows stand out even more against his face.
My God, how could anyone live through something like that?
Well, you can't, unless you got some good shelter, which you ain't likely to find around here.
Then what should we do?
Well, maybe we could go south to one of those passes you mentioned.
If it was earlier in the year, maybe. But those passes are all blocked by snow already. They're only open for a few months during the summer and early fall. Hell, nobody goes west at this time of the year.
We were delayed leaving the settlements. We had no choice but to press on.
You had a choice. You could have waited until next spring.
No, we couldn't.
Well, you're in a mess now, pure and simple. The way I see it, there's only one thing you can do. Turn around and get back east as fast as you can. Now, there's a little settlement about 120 miles east of here called Garvey's Fort. You could winter there and start out again next spring with a real guide this time. Folks don't need to start across the mountains without somebody who knows where he's going.
120 miles will take us at least 2 weeks. You said a blizzard could strike at any time.
Yeah, it can. But who knows, maybe you'll be lucky and the really bad weather will hold off for a spell. You'll make better time once you get out of the mountains and back on the plains. It'll be close, but it's the only chance you got.
Can you take us there?
You must know the way, Preacher. We'll get lost again if we don't have a guide. You as much as said so.
We won't have a chance if you don't show us the way.
Oh, God damn it. I reckon I ain't got nothing better to do. It's too late in the day to pull out now, but first thing in the morning, we'll get these wagons turned around and head east. If the berthing is over and done with by then, I mean.
There hadn't been any screams from the wagons for quite some time, but there hadn't been the squall of a newborn baby either, as Preacher had halfway expected to hear. Now, Peter looked toward the wagons.
Angela?
Preacher turned to see a woman climbing out the back of one of the canvas-covered vehicles. She was in her 20s, he judged, and she looked tired. She pushed back strands of honey-colored hair from her face as Peter and Roger hurried toward her. Her slender figure made it clear that she wasn't the one about to give birth, and Preacher figured she hadn't done it recently, or she wouldn't have looked as spry as she did. This had to be Peter Galloway's wife, who'd been helping Roger's wife, Dorothy. Along with Preacher, the older men trailed after Roger and Peter. Roger gripped Angela's hand.
Is it over? Do I have another son or a daughter?
It was a false alarm. Dorothy's not ready to give birth yet. I'm sorry.
Not ready? But I don't understand. She was in labor.
False labor. It's not uncommon, and it feels like the real thing. Sometimes it can take all day to pass, and Dorothy had an unusually strong bout of it. She's all right now, though.
I don't believe it. I was so sure it was time.
Don't you fret, Roger. I'm sure everything will be fine.
Angela looked over at Preacher.
Who's this?
Howdy, ma'am.
Oh, this is Preacher. He helped us when those Indians attacked us earlier.
I heard the shooting, but I was too busy at the time to see what was going on. Thank you, sir, for your help.
Hey, I'm just glad I came along when I did.
Preacher's going to help us get back.
Get back? I thought we were going on to Oregon as soon as Dorothy delivers.
Evidently, there's no way to get there the way we were going. And if we don't return to what passes for civilization out here as quickly as possible, we're all going to die in a blizzard.
My God, you can't be serious.
Ask him. He was the one who said it.
Is it true, sir? Are all our lives in danger?
Ma'am, y'all were in danger the first day you set foot west of the Mississippi.
When he awoke, Nakawan fully expected to find that he had died and was ready to be welcomed into the spirit world by the chief above. His physical body would be taken into the earth by Mother Corn, who had dominion over all things in that fleshly realm, and used to help make the grass grow and the flowers bloom and spring came once again to the land. Instead, he was alive. He knew that because the pain was worse than anything he had ever experienced.
He awakens.
The words came from above him, somewhere close by. Nakawan forced his eyes open and saw the grave, painted face of Badger's Den, the medicine man who had accompanied Swift Arrow's war party. The face of Badger's Den went away and was replaced by the fierce features of Swift Arrow himself.
Nakawan, where are the others?
Dead? All dead?
How?
Killed by the whites we sought. Except two dogs running. A wolf got him. The wolf was with a hair-faced white man. He killed all the others.
One man killed five Sanish warriors?
Nakawan nodded weakly. Swift Arrow turned and spoke to Badger's Den.
There was no hair-faced white man with them when they came near our village. He has joined them since then.
You think it could be the one called Preacher? He has hair on his face and travels with a wolf.
I do not know, but if Preacher is with him, is it bad medicine?
Preacher is never good medicine for his enemies.
How did you find me?
We followed the sounds of the bear. We came upon him standing over you, rolling you around on the ground with his paws. You did not move, and we feared that the bear had slain you. So we killed the bear and took his skin, and then we saw that you still lived. Though your arms and legs are dead.
Nakawan didn't know what Swift Arrow meant by that. He tried to move his arms and legs and found that he could not.
Oh, please. Please, lift my hand.
Badger's Den took the younger man's hand and raised it so that Nakawan could see it. The flesh was white and had no feeling in it, like that of a corpse. The cold had done it, Nakawan thought. The cold of the stream, and then the greater cold of the air. His arms and legs had died and would never return to life, so the rest of him might as well have died too. He could no longer hunt or fight or even take care of himself.
Slay me! Slay me!
We cannot. To do such a thing would be an insult to Nashano Nachitak, who governs all. It must be his hand who takes you. It must be the will of the chief above. But I say this to you. You will not live. The bear wounded you.
Nakawan closed his eyes and turned his head to the side, grinding his teeth together and fighting back tears.
We must go on. Tell us where to find the hair-faced one and the rest of the whites.
Nakawan swallowed hard. The war chief was right. Vengeance was all that mattered. And now the blood debt was greater than ever before. Because of the warriors who had died today. With great effort, he forced his eyes open again.
Find the stream. Follow it. There you will find the whites.
Good. Lift Nakawan and prop him against the trunk of a tree so that he can look around and see the place in which he is going to die.
Nakawan was moved to the side of a hill, with trees all around and a mountain rising before him to a snow-crested peak. To the right, the land fell away in a series of valleys so that Nakawan could see for miles and miles.
It is a good place to die.
He looked down at himself and saw that he had been wrapped in the skin of the bear. His chest and stomach burned where the bear had ripped him open while rolling him on the ground. The beast had not been trying to hurt him, only to decide what the hell he was. But the harm had been done anyway, and along with the damage he had suffered from the cold, it was all too much to be overcome. He knew that the time remaining to him could be numbered in heartbeats. The sun slipped below the peak as he watched, and the air began to grow colder. Badger's Den came to him for a final time.
We leave you now. Soon you will be with Nashanu Nachituk. Tell him that you were a brave warrior, and he will welcome you.
Nakawan nodded and could not speak. For a time, a slight warmth had come into his body, but it was gone now. Deep cold had returned. Badger's Den joined the others, and soon they vanished into the trees. Nakawan was alone on the hillside as the light faded from the sky. The bearskin was tucked snugly around him, but it did nothing to counter the frigidness that consumed him from within. As the stars began to come to life in the darkening sky over the mountains, Nakawan, whose name meant he who was fortunate, died. Wrapped in the skin of the bear. The first thing Preacher did was to get a bucket from one of the wagons and use water from the creek to put out the damn fire. It gave off enough smoke to announce their presence for miles around. Then he showed the others how to dig a fire pit, bank rocks around it, and build a fire that gave off warmth but little smoke or light.
That fire's not big enough to provide enough heat. It gets cold out here at night.
Well, now, I never would have guessed that, Peter. It's a wonder you're not in charge, what with all your vast goddamn wisdom of the great kingdom of nature. Everybody would just have to bundle up a mite more.
Do you think any more Indians will attack us?
No way of knowing just yet, Roger. Could be the ones who jumped you were renegades, and there ain't any more of them around here. But if they were from a larger war party...
Preacher hunkered down by the fire and put some coffee on to boil.
I'm still puzzled by the whole thing. Your Rickerers shouldn't have been here. Hell, they're way more agricultural than a lot of tribes, and they actually seem to like farming.
Though they hunted as well, they also traded the grain and other crops they grew to other tribes for meat. Because of their farming, they were more tied to the land and tended to wander less. Originally from farther south, most of them now lived on the plains between the North Platte and the Missouri Rivers.
There must be a mighty damn good reason for a war party to pick up and head west 100 miles into the edge of the mountains.
Preacher, when we make it to this Garvey's Fort, will you spend the rest of the winter there too?
I ain't decided that yet. Depending on the weather, I might come back up here so I can get an early start on my trapping come spring.
I was, hoping that we might persuade you to spend the winter there and then lead us on to the Oregon Territory in the spring.
No, I never signed on to be no wagon train guide.
I know that. But we've all heard of you, Preacher. Nobody knows the Rocky Mountains as well as you do. Why, you were one of the first men to explore this wilderness.
Well, one of the first white men, you mean. And even that ain't right. There was French trappers up here even before Lewis and Clark came traipsing through on their way to the Pacific. And Jesuit missionaries, too. Black Robes, the Indians call them. For a while there was even a settlement of sorts not far from here, a place called New Hope. Long gone now, of course, so there's a lot of fellows who know their way around. Hell, you could find somebody to guide you.
Well, I'll accept that for now, but I reserve the right to hope that you change your mind.
You do, huh? Well, now, you reserve all you want.
The night passed without event, and all of the children had already gone to bed. So had all three of the old-timers. Roger went off to sit in the wagon with his pregnant wife. That left Peter and Angela to sit by the fire with Preacher. After just a few minutes, Peter stood up.
I'm going to bed. Come along, Angela.
I'll wake you up in a couple hours.
Whatever for?
To stand your turn on watch, of course. You fellas post a guard and take turns standing watch, don't you?
We haven't found it necessary so far to do so.
Well, it's necessary now. It's a whole heap necessary. You'll stand two-man guard shifts, switching out every couple of hours.
Who's going to stand guard with you?
I'll be all right by myself. I ain't likely to doze off.
I could keep Mr. Preacher company. I'm tired, but not really sleepy.
Absolutely not.
I'm obliged for the offer, ma'am, but it ain't needful. You go on with your husband and get some rest.
You sure?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, then.
Angela didn't look all that happy about going off to their wagon with Peter. The creature frowned as he watched him go. Ever since he had run into these folks, he had gotten the feeling that something was wrong. He wondered if the obvious tension between Peter and Angela was part of it, or if there was something more going on. Preacher started breakfast cooking, frying some bacon and using the grease to help make some Johnny cakes. The coffee was bubbling cheerfully when Angela climbed down out of the wagon and came toward him, rubbing the sleep out of her eyes.
Cooking is my job.
And good morning to you, too.
Oh, I'm sorry. I guess I'm just not really awake yet. Usually I'm more polite. Thank you for preparing breakfast.
Well, I figure you got enough jobs around here right now, what with midwifery and all.
Preacher poured coffee into a cup.
Here you go.
Thank you. That's good. Not quite as strong as I usually make it, but still good.
Out here, you gotta stretch things and make your supplies last as long as you can. Ain't like back east where you can just walk down the street to a store and buy more of just about anything. It's usually 100 miles or more to the nearest trading post.
You know everything there is to know about living on the frontier, don't you, Preacher?
Oh, not hardly. A man who don't learn something new every day is a man who just ain't paying attention. And that's true no matter where you are, not just on the frontier.
Have you learned anything so far today?
Well, I guess you're mighty pretty, even early in the morning like this with your hair still a mite tangled up and your face all soft. But I guess that's kind of obvious, so I reckon I'll have to keep on looking. But I'll learn something before the day's over. You can count on that.
Were you born out here?
No, my family lives back in Ohio. I left home when I was 12.
You left home when you were that young?
Well, the way I saw it, a 12-year-old boy was the next thing to a man. I had to do my growing up sort of quick-like, but I managed. Worked for a spell on a keelboat and, well, why don't you just grab a plate and get you some of this bacon and Johnny cake?
After everyone had eaten, the men got to work hitching up the mule teams to the wagons. The preacher saddled his dun. As he led the horse over to the wagons, he saw Angela climbing out the back of the one where Dorothy was resting.
How's the other Mrs. Galloway this morning?
She spent a fairly restful night. She's weak, though. This confinement has been hard on her. If the baby isn't born soon, I'm not sure that Dorothy will be strong enough to handle the delivery.
Yeah, it sounds to me like she ain't got no business being way out here in the middle of nowhere.
No, she doesn't. But Roger and Peter were insistent that we start on in spite of everything. It was so late in the year when we reached St. Louis, I was sure we would spend the winter there and start west next spring.
That's what you should have done. Where are you folks from, anyway?
Philadelphia. I wouldn't mind being back there right now, either.
When the mules were hitched up and the wagons turned around so they pointed east instead of west, Preacher went from wagon to wagon, checking to make sure the men had loaded pistols close at hand in case of trouble. Preacher went to Jonathan Galloway's wagon.
Jonathan, your wagon will lead off.
I've been leading.
Roger, now you got a lady in a delicate condition riding with you. I want a wagon in front of you and a wagon in back of you for extra protection. Peter, you'll be third in line and Jeffrey, you'll bring up the rear.
Fine with me.
Peter nodded his agreement, not seeming to care where in line his wagon traveled. Preacher would take the point, but he would also have to cover their back trail since he was the only one with a saddle horse. He would scout out the best route, get the wagon started on it, then fall back for a spell to watch behind him. Then he could gallop back to the front and make sure everything was all right there. He was going to be busy riding back and forth like that, but he couldn't see any other way to do it. Preacher swung up into the saddle. Everyone who wasn't already on one of the wagons climbed aboard. Preacher walked the horse to the head of the line and waved an arm over his head.
Ho!
The sun was up, so it wasn't doing much to warm the chilly air, and the sky was a deep blue, dotted with puffs of white clouds. A light breeze blew out of the north. It was a pleasant morning, especially for this time of year on the fringes of the high country. Quickly, though, the wind began to blow harder, and the temperature, instead of rising as the sun climbed higher in the sky, started to drop. Preacher looked to the north, saw the grayish blue bank of clouds lying close to the horizon. He bit back a curse. He knew the clouds meant they were in for trouble. The only question was whether or not the storm that was on the way would be the first of the season's full-fledged blizzards, or just another teaser that would drop only a powdery dust and a white snow. By noon, most of the blue sky had been gobbled up by the onrushing clouds. The heavens were gray and ominous now. When the preacher rode alongside the wagons, he saw that the men on the driver's seats were all huddled in thick coats with their hats pulled down tightly on their heads. The two women and the kids were all inside the vehicle. The preacher hoped they were wrapped up good in blankets and quilts.
Is it going to get much worse?
Yeah, it'll get worse. I don't know how much worse, though. Right now, it's just cold, so we'll keep moving.
We could stop and build a fire.
Keep on moving.
Roger seemed to have forgotten that they had more to worry about than just the weather. It was still the little matter of that Arikara war party. So far today, in his ranging back and forth, Preacher hadn't seen any sign of engines, hostile or otherwise. His gut told him they were still around somewhere. And if the Rees were holding some sort of grudge against these white pilgrims for reasons that the Galloways didn't want to admit, they wouldn't give up their vengeance quest just because the storm was blowing in. Now there would be even more of a blood debt to settle because of the six warriors who had died in battle the day before. True, Preacher and Dog had killed them, not any one of these immigrants. But the other members of the war party wouldn't know that. Assuming there was a war party. He still didn't know that for sure. But he wasn't going to argue over much with his instincts. They had kept him alive this long, so they had to be right more often than not. The creek turned and angled northeastward. The preacher kept the wagons moving almost due east. The water barrels were full, so they didn't have to worry about running out of water anytime soon. Not only that, but there were other streams up ahead where they could refill the barrels if they needed to. Inexperienced travelers might have to follow a creek or a river to get to where they were going out here. Preacher didn't need that. He could strike out across the country and his internal compass would keep him going in the right direction. They stopped for a short time in early afternoon to rest the mules and eat a cold meal from the leftovers of breakfast. Preacher sought out Angela.
How are you holding up, ma'am?
I'm fine, Preacher. Cold, of course, but we all are.
What about your sister-in-law?
She's all right. She was a bit out of her head for a while. She seemed to think we were back in Philadelphia. She asked me to build up the fire in the stove. Then she said some things... well, they made even less sense than that.
Keep an eye on her. Now, I know in her condition she probably couldn't get out of the wagon very easy, but we sure don't want her running off and getting lost.
Don't worry. Someone will be with her at all times. Peter brought her something to eat just now.
Preacher nodded. He was gonna be mighty glad when they got to Garvey's Fort.
Someone's coming!
Preacher had one of his rifles in his hand as he talked to Angela. Jonathan shouted. He wheeled around and trotted toward the lead wagon, priming the Hawken as he went. Roger and Jeffrey joined him. The four of them gathered by the mule team hitched to Jonathan's wagon and looked to the north, where Jonathan was pointing. Two men on horseback leading a pack mule rode toward the wagons. There was a little draw not far behind them. Preacher figured that that was where they had come from. He hadn't seen them earlier, which meant they had probably stayed out of sight in the draw until they got close enough to take a good look at the wagons. Then they had emerged, figuring that these immigrants didn't represent any threat. The evident wariness told Preacher that the newcomers had at least some experience on the frontier. As they came closer and Preacher could make out more details, he decided that they were both mountain men. One wore a broad-brimmed hat, the other a fur cap with flaps that came down over the ears. Both were swathed in heavy capotes and buffalo robes, and they had rifles balanced across their saddles. Their bearded features looked vaguely familiar, which meant Preacher had probably seen him at rendezvous or some trading post, but he didn't know him personally.
Stay here.
Preacher moved out in front of the group to stand there patiently, the Hawken cradled in the crook of his arm. The two riders reined to a halt about 40 feet from him.
Howdy. All right to come into your camp?
Ain't really camp. We're just nooning a mite late today. But you're welcome if you ain't looking for trouble.
Farthest thing from it, mister.
The two men walked their horses slowly forward. One wearing the hat was heavy-set, round face, and a ginger-colored beard. The one with the cap was leaner. His black beard was shot through with gray. The men dismounted. The ginger beard nodded to Preacher.
Mart Hawley's my name. This here's my partner, Ed Watson.
They call me Preacher.
I told Ed it was you.
We seen you at Rendezvous back in the spring. Never got introduced, though.
Mart thrust out a gloved hand. Preacher shook it and shook hands with Watson, who seemed to be the quiet type. Some men acted like they forgot they ever knew how to talk after they'd spent some time in the mountains. The high country just had that effect on them now and then.
Where are you boys headed?
Well, now, that's a mighty good question. We've been debating whether to go south, east, or west. Got to go somewheres, though, because winter's nigh upon us.
It surely is.
I got to say, we didn't expect to run across no wagon train this time of year, even a little one like this.
These are the Galloways. They didn't make it through the mountains in time, so I'm helping them get back to Garvey's Fort.
Well, that'll be a hard run, what with them wagons. Closest place for some pilgrims to winter, though. There's a few cabins up in the mountains, but none big enough for a whole flock of folks like this.
Yeah, that was my thought.
Hawley looked at his partner.
What do you say, Ed? You want to head for Garvey's? Spend a winter there?
Watson gnawed at the thick mustache that hung over his lips for a moment, shrugged, and then nodded.
Sounds good to us. The onlyest thing is, I just now realized you didn't ask us to come along, and we ain't in the habit of pushing in where we ain't wanted.
Well, you can ride along with us. You gotta know, though, that there's a chance we got trouble following us. There was a ruckus yesterday. Three war party jumped these folks just as I came along. Engines wound up dead.
How many of them?
Six.
You kill them?
Yeah, me and Dog.
Preacher jerked a thumb at the big wolf-like animal who sat nearby watching the humans, his face as inscrutable as ever.
Yeah, you're a preacher, all right. Folks say you're a dangerous man.
Oh, all of them tall tales you hear about me ain't true.
But some of them are.
Preacher shrugged and turned away.
We got a few Johnny cakes left. You boys hungry?
As bears.
That morning, the war party led by Swift Arrow had backtracked Nakawan's trail to the creek. The young warrior had walked for a long way before collapsing and becoming prey for the curious bear that had ultimately provided his death shroud. The Sunish followed the creek to the west, as Nakawan had indicated. It was the middle of the afternoon before they reached the spot where the whites had camped the night before.
Look at the size of the fire the foolish white men built.
Badger's Den pointed at the large pile of ashes and partially burned wood.
No wonder Nakawan and his companions were able to find them.
They left here and headed east? Are they fleeing back to their homes?
And why did we not meet them on our way here? Our paths should have crossed.
Unless they left the creek. No matter. We will follow them. Their wagons are slow. They cannot escape from us.
So far they have.
Like most of the others, Runsfar was young and his blood ran hot in his veins. He was called Runsfar because he never seemed to tire.
We will find the whites, and their scalps will be ours.
Swift Arrow glared around at the other members of the war party, as if daring any one of them to disagree with him. None did. Runsfar looked worried that he had invoked the war chief's displeasure.
Good. We go now.
Swift Arrow started trotting along the creek, following the double lines of tracks left by the wagon wheel. The others fell in behind him. Now the preacher had some experienced men to side with him. He was able to stop spreading himself so thin.
You know the way to Garvey's, don't you, Hawley?
Yeah, we've been there. We keep hitting due east till we get out of these foothills, then we angle just a mite south.
That'll get us there. You see any signs of trouble developing, one of you light a shuck back here and fetch me while the other one gets the wagons ready.
In a circle, you mean?
If that's what it needs.
Hawley nodded, and he and Watson rode off. Preacher went the other direction, trot was done alongside the wagons as he headed to the rear. With Dog loping along beside him, Preacher dropped back a good half a mile behind the wagons, and then rode a ways both north and south, looking for any sign that the Arikara were pursuing. He didn't see any, even though they were getting out of the mountains now. This was still pretty rugged country. Preacher reined the gun to a halt and let his keen eyes scan the landscape, knowing even as he did so that there were dozens of hiding places where the Injun warriors could be concealed. He didn't see anything out of the ordinary. As he turned the horse, intending to close up the gap a little between him and the wagons, something touched his face. It turned instantly to moisture. Only a tiny drop, but enough to let Preacher know what was going on. He tipped his head back and looked up to see several more snowflakes swirling down out of the gloomy sky. They were small, and he saw only a few of them. But where there was one snowflake, there were usually millions more, just waiting to grow heavy enough to fall.
Come on, dog.
The wind was blowing harder by the time he came in sight of the wagons, still a good quarter mile in front of him. The tiny white flakes danced and darted in the air now, instead of drifting down slowly to the earth. Here and there, small patches of white had already begun to appear on the ground. The thick clouds meant the darkness could fall very early. It wasn't too soon to start looking for a place to stop, in fact. They would need at least a little shelter. Maybe the lee of a bluff, even better, a cave. The preacher hoped that Hawley and Watson had the sense to keep their eyes open and call a halt if they found such a place. The wagons rolled around a hill and went out of sight. Preacher increased the Dunn's pace, not liking it now that he couldn't see the wagons anymore. But when he rounded the shoulder of the hill a few minutes later, he saw that the wagons had driven down into a hollow. A cliff overhung it at an outward angle, providing some shelter. The place wasn't a cave, but it would have to do. They weren't likely to find anything better between now and nightfall. Hawley walked over.
Figured you'd want us to stop since it started to snow. It'll be dark for much longer, too.
That's fine. I don't reckon I could have done any better myself.
Well, that's mighty high praise coming from a famous preacher.
Look, why don't you forget about that famous business, okay? Just call me Preacher.
Sure.
Preacher walked among the wagons, checking on the pilgrims. Everybody seemed to be doing all right. Cold and worn out, but otherwise none the worse for the long day on the trail.
Is this that blizzard you warned us about?
It might be by morning.
I hope not.
Preacher built a bigger fire than he had the night before. For one thing, the temperature was considerably colder. They needed the warmth. For another, the overhang of the cliff would disperse the smoke to a certain extent, so there was less of a threat that someone could track them by. Bart Hawley had the wagons placed in a half circle at the base of the cliff. Preacher built the fire inside that circle. The heat rose and was radiated back from the rocky face of the cliff. After a while, the camp was almost warm, and everyone was grateful for that after spending the day in the biting, frigid wind. As darkness mantled the sky, the snowfall increased.
Well, dog, this maybe ain't a sure enough blizzard, but for damn sure it's more than a dusting.
Preacher went over to Roger Galloway's wagon.
Miss Angela?
What is it, Preacher?
The woman's cheeks were rosy from the cold, but other than that, her face was pale and drawn.
How's Miss Dorothy doing?
Not very good, I'm afraid. She's even weaker tonight. She doesn't want anything to eat or drink, and I'm afraid that she might be coming down with a fever.
What do you do if she is?
The best I can. But there won't be much anyone can do for her.
Does her husband know about this?
Roger knows. He's trying to keep up a brave front, but he's very frightened.
Well, now, if there's anything I can do,
I'll let you know right away. Thank you, Preacher.
Preacher nodded and turned away from the wagon. Over by the cliff, the three kids were trying to scrape up enough snow to make snowballs they could fling at each other. Even when they were mighty tired and cold, it was hard to keep a youngin's spirits down for very long. Roger, Peter, and their father Simon stood together, talking quietly. Jeffrey and Jonathan were using buckets to water the mules. Hawley and Watson stood apart from the others, apparently unsure what to do. The preacher walked over to them.
Preacher, Ed and me can move outside the circle and have our own campfire if you want.
No, that ain't necessary, Hawley. We asked you to travel with us, and that means you share our fire.
Well, we got a mite of grub we'd be glad to throw in. Ain't nothing but some jerky and pemmican, but these folks are welcome to sharing it.
Well, hang on to it for now. We might need it later if rations run short before we get to the fort.
All right, that makes sense. We feel a little bad, though, like we ain't contributing anything.
Watson jogged Hawley's arm with his elbow and gave him a meaningful look.
Well, we got some jugs of whiskey on that pack mule. Be glad to share that too, even if it is just rot good.
No, you keep it.
The preacher was right about Simon Galloway. The man already had his own stash of Who Hit John. None of the others seemed to need it.
Well, if the time comes, it's there, and we'd be glad to share it.
Obliged.
Preacher moved toward the fire. Somebody needed to start getting supper ready. Looked like he was elected. After dinner was done and everything had been cleaned up, most of the camp settled in for the night. Preacher was uneasy. He felt like taking a little look around. He picked up one of his rifles.
Dog,
big wolf-like creature followed him, padding through the snow as the creature walked quietly out of camp, away from the wagons. No one seemed to notice him leave. Preacher had been careful not to look directly into the fire too much, so he still had his night vision. He ranged out several hundred yards from the camp, pausing every few moments to listen intently for any telltale sound of someone moving in the night. But everything was quiet. When Preacher was satisfied that no Arikara war party was sneaking up on the camp, he turned and walked back to the hollow under the looming cliff. The glow from the fire was partially blocked by the encircling wagon, but it was still visible. If anyone was abroad in the night, they'd be able to see it too. But with kids and a sick woman in the party, couldn't do without the fire. All the more reason to keep guards posted all night. When Preacher got back, he found Angela Galloway pouring herself a cup of coffee.
Get the young'uns settled down for the night?
Yes. They were exhausted. They went right to sleep.
And you look about done in yourself.
Don't worry about me. I'll be fine.
They stood there quietly for a few moments while Angela sipped her coffee and the creature leaned on the rifle, grasping the barrel of the Hawken while its buttstock rested on the ground. He had taken a shine to Angela Galloway as soon as he saw her, but he knew that was wrong. He would never act on a feeling. For one thing, and most importantly, she was a married woman. The creature respected the sanctity of marriage. Even though he had left home at an early age, his parents had given him a good moral grounding and the ability to tell right from wrong. For another thing, he didn't want to be disloyal to Jenny's memory, even though it had begun to fade. Someday, Preacher figured, he'd be ready to let go of the pain, just remember the good things, but that day wasn't here yet. Preacher turned his attention over to the group of men. They were sitting a few feet from the fire. From the look of it, they had started up a card game. Preacher knew that sometimes the only thing to combat the cold was a good distraction.
No, looks like this pot is mine.
Jonathan Galloway leaned forward to rake in the pile of pebbles in the center of the blanket.
Not so fast.
Preacher was shocked to see that Ed Watson had been the man to speak.
That pot ain't yours.
What? Why not?
Because you cheated, you son of a bitch.
Preacher knew trouble when he heard it coming. He straightened from his casual stance.
Damn you, you can't talk to my uncle that way. A Galloway never cheats.
Well, he did. I seen him deal a card off the bottom of the deck.
That's preposterous. Jonathan, tell him.
Of course, I never cheated at cards in my life, and I'm insulted that you think I did tonight.
I don't think it. I know it. I seen it with my own eyes. He ain't the onlyest one, neither. It ain't no coincidence that ever since we started playing for money, one of you boys has won every hand.
You're playing for money? I thought they was playing for pebbles.
Peter stared hard at Watson.
It was you and your friend who wanted to make things more interesting, as you put it. We just went along with you, even though I didn't think it was really that good an idea. If you're too stupid to win, don't blame us and claim we're cheating.
For once, Preacher couldn't blame Peter Galloway for being hot-headed, even though Peter might have phrased his argument a mite more discreetly. If a man was honest and came from an honest family, he couldn't just let it pass when somebody accused him or his kin of cheating.
Ain't stupid. Which means I don't believe you. You're all a pack of cheaters and liars.
Peter threw his cards down on the blanket and started to get to his feet.
Take that back or I'll thrash you.
Oh my God, Peter, don't!
Watson had no intention of taking back his harsh words. Preacher knew that just by looking at the man's face. He started forward, intended to intervene into the argument, but it was too late. Watson launched himself across the blanket, uncoiling from the ground like a striped snake. Ed's fist lashed out and crashed into Peter's jaw. Peter sprawled backward on the ground, scattering the powdery new fallen snow.
Peter!
Watson continued his attack, lunging at Peter and drawing back his leg for a kick.
Thrash me, huh? You go ahead and thrash me, why don't you?
Simon, Jeffrey, and Jonathan were all too stunned by the sudden vicious assault to do anything to help Peter. Preacher could have gotten there in time to stop Watson from kicking Peter, but he held back, wanting to see what the young man would do, how he handled himself. Might come a day when Preacher would have to depend on Peter Galloway to save his life or the life of someone else. Although stunned by the punch, Peter still had his wits about him enough to see Watson's booted foot coming at him. He rolled to the side, avoiding the kick, and reached up to grab Watson's leg. He heaved on it, toppling the mountain man and sending Watson crashing to the ground. Hawley started to his feet, reaching for the pistol behind his belt as he did so, and Preacher finally stepped in. Preacher swung the Hawken up so that its barrel was pointed in Hawley's general direction.
Stay out of him, mister. Let him settle it.